Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
We welcome you again to the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and our program, Past Impressions, our program where we study the history of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and examine the people, places, events, and key issues associated with the history of the Church. I'm Brent Topp, the chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University, your host, and I am so pleased to have once again with us as our guests, Michael Landon and Mel Bayshore of the Church History Department here in Salt Lake City. Mike and Mel, welcome again to our program, Past Impressions.
Thank you.
In our last episodes, we've talked about those pioneer companies of 1848, 47, 48, 49, 50. We got up to 1851, and why don't we pick up right there and talk about the end of 51 and lead us into the significant year for the pioneer companies of 1852.
Yeah, 51 was really a down year for immigration for both Mormon and non-Mormon. Not a lot of people traveled that year, partly due, I think, to poor reports coming back about prospects in the gold fields in California, things of that nature. But also the Mormons had been, a lot of the Mormons had been pretty comfortable there in along the Missouri, and maybe they didn't think it would be such a good idea to go out to Salt Lake Valley. Maybe they didn't look at the areas being quite that appetizing, but they were needed. Mm-hmm. And so church authorities really asked them to prepare to come once the immigration season of 52 was ready. And so in 52, you do have, I think, the largest year for LDS immigration across.
It was. They received, what was it, in the fall of that year, Brigham wrote a circular?
Yeah, there was I think a First Presidency circular.
Circular. They really had reached the point where they thought the Mormons back in the Midwest were feeling really comfortable, and Brigham thought, no, we need you. You've come. We need to gather to Zion. We need to strengthen the center.
Yeah, and I think he said the language like, you think that you can wait just another year, get a better outfit, and 1 year goes by, and another year goes by. He says, you just need to come.
Yeah. So the circular was basically a priesthood admonishment to get on the trail and
That's
get
right.
going.
Yeah. Mm.
And then the Ezra T. Benson was sent to affirm that circular letter to make sure that it happened, that they would come en masse to Utah that year, not wait any longer.
And 52, in addition, was another great immigration year for all people. I mean, in fact, it may have been the largest overland immigration year.
For both Mormons and non-Mormons.
So what accounts for it? I think you've mentioned on the Mormon side, the prodding, the admonishment, the chastisement of priesthood leaders. What accounted for it for everybody else?
Well, I think it could have been – that's a good question. Trail scholars are really – they don't know exactly what it was that caused so many people to come 52. 51 had been this down year, and it could have just been they thought it over and says, no, I'm going to try it, you know. But also, I think a lot of them had been out, and a lot of these guys were returning, been out in 49, and they recognized that gold may not be the way to go, but if I could trail cattle or some other product, take it out there, I could do well. And so I think a lot of them was entrepreneurial in some respects that was motivating them. And you'll see through the years, people come out, go back, come out, go back, bringing commodities like sheep or cattle.
Well, did the same issues that that we've talked about before on the trail, were they the same issues or were there new issues that affected the companies? You know, you had those heavy use years of 1849 and 52. and 50, excuse me, are they the same things that they're struggling with now in 1852? What was the experience of 1852 like?
Well, in terms of its uniqueness, it's sheer numbers. For the Mormons, we've got easily 6,000 saints coming to Utah from the east and westbound. And that's over 1,100, 1,200 wagons with all of the livestock needed to pull those wagons and all of the other livestock that they would bring with them. How about for the non-Mormons, Mike? What numbers are we dealing with?
The numbers, well, again, these are estimates, but they're estimating 50,000 as the number.
Total immigrants.
Right. Yeah. And as we mentioned last time, Mormons could travel a little later than the rest of them. So if you've got that kind of number in front of you, the issue of forage, water quality, all those issues resurface. I don't know that disease was quite as mentioned as it had been
in the cholera epidemic and that type of stuff.
But certainly it wasn't an easy thing.
In terms of mortality in the Mormons, 200 deaths out of 6,000, about the same as in other years, about 3% mortality rate in 1852.
Was that higher or lower than the non-Mormon companies?
It's generally thought to be about the same.
Okay. All right. Well, interesting. Well, any other significant things of 52 that we really ought to focus on?
We haven't really talked too much about Indians, Mike. And really, what the general audience's perception of Indians, really, Indians were not a problem for the Mormons.
Right. Mm-hmm. And John Unruh, a trail scholar, did an analysis of people who actually died as a result of hostilities with Indians. And the numbers actually climb west of Salt Lake. Huh. You were much more likely to perish through an Indian attack west of Salt Lake than you were – you know, we think about the Great Plains tribes and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But it was actually the tribes in the Great Basin that gave the immigrants on their way to Oregon, California, the most trouble.
Interesting. Mel, why don't you tell us about the 1853 and 1854 companies? How were they unique? What were the challenges that they faced, and as we've talked about those previous companies. So let's dive right into 53.
53 and 54 are unique in that we have the saints starting a new program. They were always trying to get that edge, to bring as many saints as they could to Utah, and it's an expensive proposition. 1852, it would have cost in today's dollars around $1,000 per person to emigrate across the plains, outfit with provisions, a wagon, all your livestock to get to Utah. That's considerable. I mean, that's in today's dollars.
Right.
But you can imagine if you were a father with a family.
Right.
We're talking money here. Mm-hmm. So in 53, and this just was for the saints in England, Great Britain. They started a program to cut the cost for those saints in England to come to Utah in half of what it had been in 52. So for about $500, they made it a little bit more affordable for the poor to come to Utah. And they called that the 10-pound company.
Hmm.
10-pound.
The British pound.
British pound, the 10-pound company. And so you had a lot of people that were then able to take advantage of this. They could then afford to come to Zion. And with that 10 pounds, you were able to pay for the shipping and food from Liverpool to New Orleans if you went on a ship in steerage.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't your first class accommodations. But and then that would also pay for your steamboat up the Mississippi River. And then in 54, they went a little further. They in 53, they started in Keokuk, Iowa.
Uh-huh.
And then in 54, with another version of that same program, they upped the price a little in 54 to 13 pounds. They found in 53 that that 10 pounds really didn't go far enough. These people ended up literally starving at the end of the trek. Mm-hmm. But the cost of that also paid for the lowest deck on a steamboat to go up the Mississippi. Sometimes you had to sleep there with the cargo and on deck. And food was not included on your steamboat ride. Maybe you could put a line over the side and fish for buffalo fish in the Mississippi or something. But and it paid for your basic food in the outfitting camp when you got up the river. And then it paid for an outfit for crossing the plains, which included a tent, one wagon, two yoke of oxen, and two milk cows for every 10 people. And then it would pay for provisions for every 10 people from the outfitting camp to Council Bluffs, and then provisions for every 10 people who were starting at Council Bluffs to cross the plains to Utah. Huh. But it just wasn't enough to really pay for it. The church had to end up coming from Salt Lake to save a lot of those people. Mm. It they ran out of food far in advance. Here's one account of this. This is a woman who was expecting, and she gave birth on October 1st, and they were still 10 days out of Salt Lake. And she said, "We traveled along day after day, each day our provisions getting less, and the journey very rough. We started out with a pound of flour a day, then a half a pound, then a quarter of a pound a day, and then it got to nothing at all." And she said on the day that her first child, her young Annie, was born, the 1st of October, 1853, there was not a spoonful of anything in camp.
Oh, man, that makes it so tough.
It was. And, so the Salt Lake realized that they needed to do a little more. They needed to have a little more cash the next year to make this program work, but it only lasted the 2 years.
And so this was just the British Saints then?
Just the British Saints. It was not open to anyone else.
Okay. And so did we have other companies? I mean, that's the program that was formed, but did we have other saints coming from elsewhere that would meet up with the same companies?
Yeah, there were other companies that weren't on this 10 or 13-pound program. So there were just the normal independent companies or other church
and were
companies.
were they also connecting in Keokuk, or were they just meeting up in Council Bluffs wherever they were coming from?
Okay. Right.
And so it was Council Bluffs that was still basically the starting point for all of the things.
Those who were living in the States would head to Council Bluffs to outfit to go across the plains. That's the Mormon story.
Why don't you tell us, Mike, about the non-Mormon companies of 53, 54 and their experiences.
Again, the numbers were pretty large. We don't know actual figures. But one of the interesting things is you have this cattle and sheep trailing industry, really. Mm-hmm. We talk about the great cattle drives from Texas. The real major cattle drives were antebellum. I mean, they were going all the way across the country.
How about that?
And they would go through Salt Lake. And there was one county went through Salt Lake with sheep. They had the sheep sheared. They sold the wool in Salt Lake. And then they took the sheep herd down to Southern California. We have one company that left with 8,000 head of sheep from Missouri and arrived in California. After passing through Salt Lake, they arrived in California with 6,000 head. And even with that attrition rate, they turned a tidy profit. Another company that same year had 2,500 sheep when they got to California.
Hard to even imagine companies like that with that many sheep.
And in 54, there was one that had 10,000 fine stock sheep that they left the Missouri with. And the governor of California, in his annual message to the California legislature on the 1st of January, 1855, reported that 62,000 head of cattle had entered the state that previous immigration year. And he breaks it out by the different trails, of which there were many. But 62,000 head, at least, had entered the state. And if you figure what your attrition rate is as you go back down the trail, the numbers who started, it was a pretty sizable. amount of animals on the trail. And considering that the Mormons traveled, again, they could travel, they could start later, they didn't have to go as far, what impact that may have had on the ability for Mormon stock to forage, if you've got that kind of numbers.
Mel, one of the things that I found very interesting as you and Mike have talked about these various companies is that each company seems to have its own unique personality or unique contributions or challenges. Why don't you take us with what was unique about 1855?
Yeah, it's not only each company that has a unique characteristic, but each year seems to have some facet that's different than the other years. And for 1855, that was a small year for overland travel. There was an article in the New York Times that year that said, except for Mormon immigration and commerce and the movement of government troops and stores, the plains would present a desolate appearance this season, very different from anything that has been seen since 1849. It was different in that way, and for Mormon travel, I think Mike and I have both we didn't come planned what we were going to speak on today, but both of us have keyed in on a very unique, very particular, interesting company that came, a Mormon company that came to Utah in 1855, unique in many ways. First of all, it started out in Texas.
That's right. Oh. These are Texas immigrants, and they're trailing cattle, no less.
Okay. Yeah. In fact, the man who leads the company, he was converted in Texas. He was a Texan, and his name
was
Seth
Blair. When
you
say they were converted, how was this from the Lyman Group there? How were they introduced to the church in Texas? So you end up with a pioneer company from Texas.
Let's begin with Seth Blair. He joins the church, and he had a colorful fellow. He was a Texas Ranger early on in the very beginnings of that republic, and then joined the church and came to Utah in 1850. Served here for a while as the U.S. District Attorney, and then the church in 1854 called him to go back to Texas
as a missionary. Okay, that's an interesting link.
Yeah, and so he then baptizes quite a few people in Texas and then gathers about 50 of them to come to Zion.
That's an interesting company that I wasn't even familiar with.
Well, you know, and most people don't expect that the Mormon Trail is going to begin in Texas, but for these 80-some people, that's where it started for them.
So they
followed Seth Blair up from really near Dallas area northward.
And they're at Mormon Grove, not farther north. So they're leaving from, I guess it would be near present-day Atchison.
Atchison. Mm-hmm.
Where their jumping-off point is to start going west. And what's interesting about this train is, okay, this is 55, so it's a year before the handcarts.
Right.
This train gets ravaged with cholera.
No.
It is astounding, the number of people. And Seth Blair, in his diary, and also I believe in a report that he sent to Brigham, describes this horrific tragedy that's occurring in this company. And this is right as they're just starting out. And he talks about, as they left, he said, we left on the first, and having traveled some 20 miles, the cholera made its appearance in our camp. On the night of Monday the 17th, and in the first 24 hours, we lost 12 or 13. And up to this time, I presume we have lost not less than 20 and at least the fifth of our whole strength.
Wow.
The camp presenting for the last 4 days a cholera hospital. Then he goes on and describes the people who don't even know that other members of the company have died. I mean, you know, they're healthy in the morning and they're dead by 5 in the afternoon. And he makes one interesting statement. He says, describing the elders that are with him, they're trying to take care of all these people who are ill. And he said, to give a more particular idea of the sorrowful state of things, those who dug the graves and buried the dead went from camp to wagon, seeking who was dead, and thus persons died and was buried a day before others knew that they were even sick. The elders with me are worn down, and to their constancy and faithfulness I could not add a laurel. They are indelibly stamped on the hearts of every man and woman in this camp, and their names I wish perpetuated to my latest posterity. And so he lists the names, but he mentions that he just couldn't remember all of the names of those who had helped. And recently we acquired a diary of a man whose name was William Brockerman Wright, and he was one of those that Blair couldn't, whose name Blair could not remember. And in his account, he describes people dying, and he said, I went out and helped dig the graves and also one for a child that died during the evening. Then this is on the 19th of June, he's describing this. Then he stops writing. You don't have anything for many days. And on the 27th of June, he starts writing again. I again resume my journal. I've had the cholera so bad for the last week, I've not been able to move out of my wagon and, in fact, have been so low as to be given up by my friends who went and dug me a grave.
Oh, my goodness.
But thank God I was not ready to be laid in the ground yet.
Wow, what a powerful, powerful account. That's a great example of faithfulness and the sacrifice of those saints. What are your impressions? What are the general feelings that you have about these pioneer companies of these important years?
You know, we've just talked about a very unique company that suffered horrendous number of deaths. In fact, their death count, the percentage of deaths in their company outstripped the percentage of deaths in the Willie and Martin Hancock companies greatly. More than a third of the members of the Seth Blair's company had died. But for me, it's not so much, even though death happens in the history of the saints crossing the plains. For me, it's the success of the effort that brought so many saints to Utah that is the overriding impression that I have. Brigham Young and his ability to organize to bring thousands, over 60,000 people to Utah over that time period.
Leonard Arrington called him the American Moses.
The American Moses.
And that is really a great observation.
Right. I have an article, and this is wasn't written until 1868, but out of Macmillan's magazine in 1868, and they recognized the importance of the emigration in building up the church and making the church a growing and strong entity in the world, and its success. It said the superior success of Mormonism to that of other American religions. I take to arise from the fact that it is grafted upon a system of emigration. It mentions that he said, can you imagine if you didn't have the church to help you emigrate, the feelings that you would have as a single person on your own or with a family trying to emigrate? It mentions here, let everybody imagine what it must be to ordinary laborers who have never known anything of the world beyond the limits of their parish, to set forth without friends or acquaintances, to seek their fortunes in a strange country where they know nobody. They would like well enough to go, but they're afraid of going. But not the Mormons. The Mormons have it built in. You've got your, as it says here, converts to the Mormonism have emigration made easy to them. The whole responsibility of the journey is taken off their hands. They are escorted on the road by men they know. Amongst their fellow converts, that they have friends, or at any rate acquaintances, already provided for them. And they know that when they reach the faraway land, which seems to them so utterly beyond their mental vision, they will find homes and lands and employment awaiting them.
Isn't that interesting, the parallel that we would have to the modern church of an elder's quorum presidency and quorum packing up and moving someone, helping them along the way, and when they arrive, they've got a ward. They've got a built-in social network. That's a very, very interesting observation.
And I would second essentially what Mel said. We were successful, incredibly successful,
And sometimes I get a little concerned that we tend to emphasize to some degree some of the tragic episodes,
And
I can understand. There are some – I mean, there's value in that too. But I think we need to never forget this was a successful immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there were lots of people on the trail besides Mormons, and it impacted us. I found one quote that I think kind of sums up Brigham Young – this was done in 1863, made the statement, and he'd had time to reflect on all of the immigration that had passed through the Salt Lake Valley and what it all meant. And he said that we had anticipated when we came into these distant valleys that we should be entirely secluded from the world, that we should trouble no person, and that no person would trouble us. The Mormon battalion had been disbanded in California, and some of that body first discovered gold there. The news of that discovery quickly reached the eastern states, and thousands were soon upon our track. Instead of being secluded, we find ourselves in the great national highway. And then he adds, we must be known, and we could not be in a better situation to be known than where we are.
Mm.
And so I think at first he must have thought, I just get out here, now I'm being inundated. But then, as time passes, he reflects, there's a reason for us being where we're at.
Uh-huh.
We're actually located where we need to be because we have to be known. Yeah.
And it was much better for the saints than had they gone to California.
That's correct.
Or things like that.
Exactly.
So what do you brethren want your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, and future generations to never forget about the Pioneer Trail companies?
It's the perspective. To me, that's one of the most important lessons that could be learned from this. You go through your day-to-day, and you have your share of troubles.
Mm-hmm.
But all you have to do is pick up somebody's immigration account and read what the challenges they faced, the obstacles they overcame. And I think it's an empowering thing because you can internalize that and reflect on your own life and say, maybe I ought to just rethink just how tough my life is and what kind of challenges I'm facing, and maybe even reading the accounts either of direct line ancestors or others.
Mm-hmm.
You can draw strength from their ability to overcome challenges, internalize that lesson, and apply it to your own life.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very powerful emotional appeal to reading the words of somebody who went through a 1,000-mile trek across the continent.
And I think that's what links every Latter-day Saint, wherever they are in the world, to that story. I mean, it is not just that you have an ancestor that was on that trail, but the messages of faith and courage and dedication and obedience.
Exactly.
That we all, whether we're first-generation converts from Nigeria, we still have a relationship. Mel, what would be your observation that you want your posterity to never forget about these pioneers?
I think that there's a little nugget of wisdom that this author in that Macmillan's magazine mentioned, that they didn't do this alone. Mm-hmm. That they had help not only from their fellow man, but they had help from on high too.
Yeah.
And there were times when, sure, the crossing of the plains was a get up one day, a walk, and go to bed, and then get up the next day and do it again. A lot of mundane walk and walk and walk.
Especially on the Wyoming, thinking at day after day after day.
Right. There was a lot of that where you have to simply just keep plodding ahead, and then you will get there.
Yeah, that's a great message. Thank you both so much for inspiring us and instructing us and sharing with us things that are so insightful and inspiring. Mel and Mike, thank you so much for being guests today on Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Thank you for having us.